Who said that? You heard that? I don't know if that's so pushing. Huh?
That special for seminary evidence.
Is that what they said?
I don't know.
Yeah. I mean, the way I would approach it is I would say that the woman is doing the most that she can to help her husband learn. If he is not doing it, then HaKadosh Baruch Hu will reward her for her machshava and her motivation based on the principle that Hashem takes a good thought of a person who wants to do a mitzvah and they're not able to do it for reasons beyond their control, so it's treated like they did the mitzvah.
That's how I would answer it. Does that mean that there's a fault in her, that the reason, since she's not worthy of a husband, she's not worthy of a chelik in a very strong learning, therefore she's stuck with somebody who is not.
Well, that's a tricky question.
Has she been worthy?
I understand. You know, maybe so, but maybe not, because there are other cheshbonos that maybe the tafkin of her neshama is to take a guy who would have been a zero and bring him up to a plus one. Right, so good. He's not a 10, he's not a 5. But she brings him up. And that's a very difficult avodah. It's a very sad avodah. But sometimes a person's avodah, that's the job of her, the job of her neshama, is to bring him up. And I can't tell you in any given case, it might be that she's such a tzedekes that her job was that she's the only one that has the koach to bring him up to one. So I wouldn't say, you know, it's a failure on her. It's certainly a disappointment. I've seen, even in Mishpacha magazine, I've seen anonymous letters, very, very sad letters about wives who have said, you know, I thought I married somebody for this and this thing, and it's not, and whatever. But sometimes that's a person's avodah. Sometimes a person's avodah is to be mashpia on somebody who otherwise would have been totally, totally bent. And she brings them someplace. And sometimes, by the way, you should know too, that sometimes her chelik might be in the children that she brings into the world. Right? She, even if she was not zocha to marry a person who learns and is a Talmud Chacham, you know, she might bring children who are zocha to that, and precisely because they see their mother's mesiras nefesh. I mean, I know a number of cases where either the man was not religious, or the man was certainly not learned, but the wife had a great avas Torah, and her children became Talmidei Chachamim, because the woman is the dominant person. I even know one case, which is very bizarre, of an intermarriage that worked that way. That she was a Jewish woman who married a guy. Why? I don't know why, but it just happened at a time. Maybe she wasn't from or whatever. And she stayed married to the guy, but the guy didn't care how she raised the kids. She raised the kids for him. The kids went to yeshiva. The kids became rabbanim. Strange. So there are many, many strange things that happen. So I wouldn't automatically say that the woman, has something wrong with her in that way. It might be for care. It might be she has an unusual koach that Hashem, like an army, Hashem had to use her for a certain task that other people would not have been able to do.
Women have stronger impact on the children than men, or men?
Yeah, by and large they do. The Medrash says. And we learned it. We learned this. This is the pasuk in the beginning of the parak. Chachmas nashim bansa besa. Remember, the wisdom of a woman builds the house. So the Medrash says, I believe, on this pasuk itself, that a maisa, a non-religious man, married a religious. What happened was there was a couple. They were both religious. And they didn't have children, so they decided they had to get divorced. And the religious woman married a non-religious man, and the religious man married a non-religious woman. And the Medrash tells us the non-religious woman made the religious man a Rasha, and the religious woman made the non-religious man she married into a tzaddik. And that's Chachmas Nashim Bansa Besa. That's why this feminist agitation is very misplaced. I mean, women are saying, you know, we don't have rights, and this and that. The truth of the matter is, the power of an Eishes Chayil in a home is much stronger than anything, than the man getting an aliyah in Shul or whatever.
Does that mean, like, Beis Yaakov is more important than Yeshiva?
Well, we talk about this. I mean, basically, Gedolim have said, which was Shach, I mean, Gedoli Ador have said that people ask the Rav Shach, who is the biggest Marbitz Torah?
What's Marbitz?
The spreader of Torah. So some people said Chavetz Chaim or whatever it is, Rav Chaim Soloveitchik. He said the biggest Marbitz Torah is Sarah Schneer. Sarah Schneer was the founder of the Beis Yaakov movements in the 1920s in Krakow. Because Sarah Schneer was responsible for creating a system which taught young women not only about Yiddishkeit, but taught them to be Machshiv Torah and to want to raise families of B'nai Torah. And he says she gets all the credits for whatever resurgence of Torah we have in the world today. So yeah, for sure. Going all the way back to Rabbi Akiva and Rachel, right? Rabbi Akiva's wife, Rachel. She married an Amoritz. He was 40 years old, didn't know anything. And she sent him to yeshiva. He was 22 years. And he became back. I'm sorry, 22 years. And he became the Gadol Hador. 24 years. 24 years with 24,000 Talmidim. Yeah. And Rabbi Akiva said, Shali v'shalachem shalahu. My Torah and your Torah is only because of her.
The relationship that a woman, when she's funding her husband to learn, and a wealthy person a person to learn, the same schar a wealthy person would get, the wife would get, right? That relationship of a supporter to the husband, to the person who's learning, would be able to say. Yeah, but the fact that she's, this lady is married to him, does that increase her halak?
The relationship of a husband and a wife is beyond Yisachar and Zvulun, right? Yisachar and Zvulun, we had the debate about 50-50. Here, it for sure is 100-100, because we say Ishtar Kagufo, and therefore if she is the one that encourages her husband, she gets exactly the same schar. And maybe more, depending on her suffering or whatever it would be, because sometimes, you see, the man might enjoy learning, he gets a geschmack, and the woman has a lot of suffering. So that's cheshbon into the schar, because the pleasure versus the suffering is also a calculation in the divine schar. Okay.
Is there a particular role of paskin in this situation?
Are we paskin?
Yeah.
Well, you see, a woman gets at least equal schar with her husband. I mean, that's what we said. Okay. Now, if you look at pasuk yudbeis. Yesh derech yasher lifnei yish v'yacharisa darchei mavis. There is a path that looks perfectly straight for me, right? I need to get to a destination, right? So I see a house in the distance, and it looks like a straight road. But sometimes a path that looks like it's very straight might lead to the pathways of death. There may be mines there, there may be bombs, there may be terrorists. So what is the Pasuk telling us? So here the Gra says a very simple thought, but a very important thought. And he says that the word Ish, as opposed to Adam means every human being, made from the dirt. Ish is always a term of distinction, Chashivos. And in particular, the word Ish is used for a Talmid Chacham. And this pasuk is talking about a Talmud Chacham. And what the lesson is, how a person should not be Saimech on his own Seichel. That a person needs to be Miyayetz with other people. A person needs to have Chavrusa in life. Now, it doesn't mean 24 hours a day. But a person will be Nichshal when he relies on his own Seichel. And that's what we're saying. Something looks Nichshal, he will stumble if he relies on his own seichel. And this is why Chazal say, "Asei lecha rav, uknei lecha chaver." Person has to have a rav. Person has to have a chaver, because by myself, my judgment can be distorted. I can see things in an incorrect way. Sometimes I make a decision based on my negias. I have a personal agenda. In fact, they say, sometimes a person in an argument will start off saying, it's not personal, it's a matter of principle. So they say, anytime you say it's not personal, it's a matter of principle, it always means it's personal. Somebody went to Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky and once complained about something done to him that he considered was a big, big avla. It was unfair. So Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky said to him, you know, these things have happened many times before to other people. Did they upset you when they happened to other people? He says, well, he says, I didn't think about it so much. He says, well, then it's just a personal grievance that you have. It's not, I mean, like a person was talking, we have to be mesakin for Klal Yisrael. We have to, you know, we can't allow this avla to go on. Rav Yaakov said, if you weren't bothered when it happened to somebody else, then it's your personal ethics. So go to a din Torah. I mean, you have a right. If, even if it's a personal thing, I have a right to address it. But don't start parading that you're doing it in order to be mesakin Klal Yisrael. In some particular way. The Sfarim say, Sfas Emes says, that this is even the meaning of marriage, right? By marriage we say, Ezer Kenegde, right? Ezer Kenegde. So the Gemara itself asks the Kasha, a woman is supposed to be an Ezer, a helpmate, to be Kenegde, opposite. So Frek de Gemara, opposite implies opposition. Is she a helper? Or is she an opposite? So the Gemara itself gives a very pragmatic answer. If you're Zaycha, you get an Ezer. If you're not Zaycha, you get a Kenegde. Some people get one type of spouse. Some people get the other type of spouse. But the Sfas Emes says that in a deeper Havana, the idea is the Ezer of marriage is Kenegde. The fact that the other person sees the world in a different way. If you had a clone of yourself, meaning you had an exact carbon copy of yourself, the Emes says there would be no toelis in that relationship. You would be talking to yourself. Every decision you make would be right in her eyes, your eyes, because you're the same. It's precisely the Nakuta that Avram and Sarah, right, they discussed, right? They had a chiluk edeis about Yishmael, Yitzchak and Rivka. The pshat is, the whole purpose of marriage is that we broaden our ability to understand the world by having someone that sees the world in a different way. So the Sfas Emes says, Ezer is Kenegde. Now, I don't mean Kenegde, certainly machlokes, bitterness, dissension, fighting, that's not good. But Kenegde in the sense of seeing different nekudas. This is the whole union of a chavrusa, whole union of a chabura. The Gemara even says it by Rav Yechanan and Reish Lakish. Remember, all of you know the story. Reish Lakish was Rav Yechanan's brother-in-law. Originally, Reish Lakish was a bandit. He was a robber. And he attacked Rav Yechanan, etc. And Rav Yechanan said, you know, if you learn Torah, you'll marry my sister, etc. He didn't check with his sister first, but whatever, he assumed that she would be maskim. And what happened was Reish Lakish became one of the great Gedolei Hador. And his relationship to Rabbi Yochanan, although he also started learning late, although we don't know about Reish Lakish's childhood, and we don't know if it was like Rabbi Akiva, we're not sure. But obviously Reish Lakish had a few years when he was off the derech, as we would describe it today. And Reish Lakish eventually became a Talmud Chaver. Talmud Chaver is a very unusual, not just a Talmud. Talmud Chaver, meaning you are a disciple, but you're kind of an equal also. And Reish Lakish can argue with Rav Yochanan because of that, although the halacha is like Rav Yochanan. So it mentions, whenever Rav Yochanan would say anything, Reish Lakish would ask him 24 kashas. 24 kashas! Mamish, imagine a Talmud interrupting his shir. Every time the Rebbe says a chiddush, 24 kashas! And Rav Yochanan answered. So be it as it may, there was a whole sad story. Reish Lakish died, tragically. And Rav Yochanan didn't have a Talmud of that caliber. So they brought in Rav Kahana to be a Talmud. And every time Rav Yochanan said something, Rav Kahana brought 24 rayas that Rav Yochanan was right. 24 rayas. So people thought Rav Yochanan would be very happy. Oh, now instead of this guy who was always trying to raise questions, now 24 rayas. So Rav Yochanan started crying, and he said, "Vay lei l'Reish Lakish, alas, alas, I don't have Reish Lakish." So the Talmidim asked him, what do you mean, Rish Lakish? Every time you said something, Rish Lakish, question after question after question after question. And Rav Kahana shows that you're right. Rav Yochanan said, I don't need somebody to prove that I'm right. If I didn't think I was right, I wouldn't have said it. So I think I'm right. He brings Nacharaya, Nacharaya. But when Rish Lakish would ask me, then I would see, and either by answering his kashas, I would understand my own yisaid, the Torah, better, or if I made a mistake, I would be chayzer. That's what a person, that's how you grow. That's how a Rebbe grows. That is the yisaid of mitalmida yaser mikula. And therefore he said that the whole godless of the Talmud was the idea of the questioning and making the person rethink and not simply bring rayas to that. And the same thing is true in a marriage as well. That's the Azer Kenegdai. You don't need necessarily somebody to say you're right all the time. Of course, you shouldn't have a marriage where you're wrong all the time. That's a bit of a stira in Shalom Bayis too. But it should be something in which you grow from each other. You learn from each other. You see the world in a different way. Sarah and Avram were different personalities. Yitzchak and Rivka were different personalities. That Avram was the chesed, and Sarah was gevura, and Rivka was chesed, and Yitzchak was gevura, etc. And Yaakov is more complicated because you had four women, four wives that Yaakov is involved in. So Yaakov is emes, which combines all of these different qualities. So that's the idea of yesh derech yosher lifnei ish, that sometimes a person thinks, I'm so convinced that this is the right step. But in reality, it turns into mavas. Because without a chaver, without somebody you can talk things out, you just don't see the whole picture. You don't see the thing. Your vision is very, very incomplete.
Doesn't that mashma that a person, when he has a lot of wives, it's mashma that he has many affairs because he needs so many wives to fix him? If a person has one wife, it means it's a simple affairs, simple tikkunim, and just one is enough to fix him?
Well, I wouldn't say necessarily many averis, but I would say that he may have a complicated personality. So yeah, so there are different ways that there has to be a tikkun. Yeah, I think that would be correct in some ways, that when you embody many different types of midos, at least before the Rabbeinu Tekkan, Rabbeinu Gershom.
Doesn't that mashma that Rivka, she was a higher madriga because she was able to, just by herself, she was able to fix Yitzchak. Or maybe Yitzchak was on a high madriga because he only needed one wife to fix him.
You could say it either way or both ways. You know, you can't, it's not a riot to the wife, it could be a riot to the husband. Yeah, so you don't always know. Okay. I had one more raya about this. Selecha Rav. Of course, they say, it's really a drush. They say, aselecha rav, make for yourself a rav. And in fact, it's interesting. Let's take someone like Baruch Ber. Baruch Ber, Leibovitz, was one of the greatest Rosh Hashivas in Europe. He was one of the Gedolei Ador. He was really a great, great Rosh Hashiva. And he was in Gansen, a Talmud of Rav Chaim Soloveitchik, who was totally mevatel himself to Rav Chaim. Ad kidei kach, he was already an Eloi when he came to the Volozhin Yeshiva. He was an Eloi, he was 17 years old. He had suitcases of chidushim. But because they were not Rav Chaim's derech, he burnt them. He burnt them. He didn't want to say anything. In fact, I have to say, Rebecca Kamenetsky said later, I would never say such a thing, but he said that he felt as great as Rav Baruch Ber was, he would have been greater had he allowed his natural personality to develop. Rav Baruch Ber literally didn't want to do anything that wasn't Rav Chaim. That's a controversial idea a little bit. But be this as it may, Rav Baruch Ber held, because of this idea of nullifying himself, that he had to have a Rebbe all of his life. So when Rav Chaim was Nifter, so Rav Baruch Ber, who had been a Rosh Yeshiva for a number of years, made himself the Talmud of the Brisker Rav. Now the Brisker Rav was much younger than Rav Baruch Ber. But he said, your father was my Rebbe, you're now my Rebbe. And he's mevatel himself to the Brisker Rav. Very unusual. Rav Olba was somewhat the same. Rav Olba, great, great Baal Musar, was, of course, a very close Talmud to Rav Yeruchim of Mir. Rav Yeruchim died, Rav Yeruchim died even before the war. Rav Yeruchim died, I think, in the late 1930s. And then Rav Volba became a Talmud of Rav Chaska Levenstein. Now I don't know exactly, there are a number of gap years I can't account for, but when Rav Huttner came to Eretz Yisrael in the 1970s, Rav Huttner was younger than Rav Volba. Rav Huttner, or at least maybe the same age, Rav Volba became a Talmud of Rav Huttner. Rav Huttner has a very, very unique derech of Hashkafa, the Pachad Yitzchak. I don't know if you're familiar with it. It's kind of a Litvisha, Chassidus, Kabbalah. It became very, very popular. Moshe Shapiro, for example, was somewhat of a Talmud of Rav Huttner. So Moshe Shapiro's derech is essentially Rav Huttner's derech exported to Eretz Yisrael. So Rav Volba used to sit. Rav Volba was a mashgiach. Rav Volba had written the Ali Shur, which is, if you look at the Ali Shur, you see, the Ali Shur, you can see how much knowledge Rav Volba had of the Svarim and Yanim of Machshava, and Yanim of Hashkafa. Like, he knew all of these Svarim, you know, starting Mara Nebuchim and the Derech Hashem and the Sefer Ikarim and the Chayvas Alavavas and the Kuzari. And besides all the Midrashim, all the Mamari Chazal, it's a tremendous Sefer of Bekiyas. In the Yonim of Machshava, and then to put it together. So he was someone who, you know, knew. He had mastered Musar and Hadracha and Hashkafa and techniques of Chinuch and how to influence Talmidim. And he had done this for decades. So, and he sits in the front row with guys who are like, you know, 22 years old or whatever. And Huttner is sitting in the Mimer. And Rav Volba has a notebook, not even a tape recorder. And he's taking notes, you know, of Rav Huttner's Mamorim and the like. Because Rav Volba was looking for a Rav. He wanted a Rav. He wanted a Rav. A Selecha Rav. Of course, another way of describing it, besides a Selecha Rav, is the Medrash says that Talmidei Chachamim are compared to fish. That when Yaakov gave the bracha to Ephraim and Menashe, V'yidgu l'rayv, they should be like dogim. That Am Yisrael and Talmidei Chachamim Bifrat are compared to fish. So there are a lot of comparisons. One is that since the fish are covered up, there's no Ayin Hara, people aren't staring at the fish, there's no Ayin Hara, so we should be immune from Ayin Hara. But the Medrash says a beautiful thing. A fish is totally surrounded by water. But when it rains and it gets the appearance of a new drop coming into the water, they rush up to get the drop. No matter how much water they have, they want to get another drop. Makes no sense.
Think it's food.
They probably think it's food. Yeah. But at least the way, no, that's what they think. Yeah, but the picture. Again, you have to understand when Chazal give midrashim like this, they're not giving the scientific explanation. They're giving what it looks like. It looks like water is coming, and they want water. That's what I see. Like that. That's so. Mimele Talmud Chacham that way also. Anybody, so Rav Volba, right? If he can hear something from a footer, he wants to hear it. That's what they say with Rav Yashu. Rav Yashu was one. They once. This is a, I don't know if Art Scroll uses it for advertising, it's a good advertising, that there's a picture of Rebel Yashiv looking at the Hebrew Art Scroll Gemara. he's looking at a footnote for something. So what's the pshat? What the answer is, you know, he's a person who learned Torah for 90, 95 years already, you know, 95 years. And yet, if maybe some Kailo guy, whoever translated, whoever did that page, has some Mare Makam, some Svara, some thing, that maybe the Gadol didn't know. And it happens sometimes, you know. Not everybody, I mean, even Rebbe Yashiv didn't know every single thought in every single Sefer.
Babli or Zalman?
This was Babli. Babli, yeah. So that's the idea, that you look. They had a story talk just on Purim. There was a, I don't know the person's name, but apparently he was a big, big Talmud Chacham. It's amazing. In Yerushalayim, Befrat, other places as well. There are anonymous people. They're not Rosh Hashivas. They're not famous. They just happen to know Kala Torah Kula. The people hang around. So apparently there was a Ger Chassid who was Mefursim. Well, he wasn't totally unknown, but he had no position anywhere. But he was a tremendous, like, Bucky Kala Torah Kula. So on Purim, his job was to stump Rav Yashiv. Rav Yashiv would tell him, okay, I want you to teach me something I don't know. Teach me a chazal or something I never heard before. So the person, he only stumped him on the eighth one. He told him like seven very obscure Mamari chazal. Rav Yashiv, no, no. Rabbi Eliyahu, Medrash Rabba, Second Rabbi Eliezer. The eighth one, he got him on something. He said, Yosef Hakatakat, Baruch Hashem. He said, you made my Simchas Purim, you told me something I never heard before. They also say this. This is actually a little bit of a harder to understand. That they wanted to put out a cherem against the internet or something. I'm sure they must have done it already, but whatever. But they wanted to put out a cherem against the internet. They wanted Rebbe Yashiv to sign on a cherem against the use of the internet.
Cool.
Yeah, can't use the internet. Cannot use the internet. So he refused to sign. He says some people need to use it. So rumor has it that somebody used a HebrewBooks.org or someone used a website to find a certain tshuva that he had never seen before. And they showed him something new. And he said, I got this from the internet. I wouldn't have known where to find it. So he says, hey, Bazai, I can't answer. He says, there's a Tawelis. There are Sakanis. But if we could create Torah, if we could bring Torah to the world, that I would not have known otherwise. He says it's not Shaykh Tasser. He says it had a tailor.
Have they tried to put Harem on Facebook? Just like one website? Like not the whole website, but just.
Well, there's a good svara for that. I don't know why I don't know why they haven't done that. That's an interesting issue. It's after the whole internet, you'd be losing out the databases and things. But Facebook, again, I don't know. Go to the Badats and talk to them about it. Okay. Maybe they'll probably say, what's Facebook? What's Facebook? Okay. Yeah.
He said there wasn't
for families in Eretz Israel, they have family in America, they want to share pictures with their parents.
Yeah, but they're
There are other ways of doing it.
He said there wasn't a din that he didn't hold. It was just a din like Moshe Rabbeinu didn't want to hit the water.
Aha. You heard that? Yeah. Was the pshat? That's interesting. That's very interesting. He had a karsa type to the internet, so he couldn't pass her. In other words, that would mean he wouldn't mind if anyone, some other people asked her.
Yeah.
He just did. Oh, that's very interesting. That's exactly very interesting. Yeah.
I heard that fish, they have a very high conversion of. They think their food and they have high conversion to their flesh versus the animal. I think the animal is 20%, fish is 70%. That's why
they're very efficient.
So basically, like Talmud Chacham also, anything they eat, it becomes them, it becomes their flesh. But that's like when the animal says 20%
that's a nice shot. That's right. Because you need, a cow has to eat like 20 pounds of grass to have 1 pound of meat. Yeah,
for people who do fish farming, I heard this. They were giving this as a milo.
That's a good shot. That's very nice. Okay. Yeah, but that's the importance of having a rebbe, having a chaver, having a wife. All of these things are mechubar, because a person's own perspective is going to be limited. Yeah, we don't understand things, and we think things are so yashor when in fact there can be a chorban. Okay. 1 second. Yeah, look at the pasuk, the next pasuk Yud Gimel. Yeah, gam bischaik yichav leif. Yacharisa simcha tuga. Gam bischaik yichav leif means also in laughter or levity, the heart will have pain. Yacharisa simcha, and in the aftermath of simcha, can be tuga. Tuga is also despair. So it seems to be saying two things. Both of them are kind of sequential. One is, at the moment, during the schaik itself, there can be sadness. And the aftermath of the simcha is tuga, also despair. So what does the pasuk mean? So here I want to read some of this inside. So the Gra says here, HaPasuk hazeh ein lahavin biyomrei gam. What is gam? Also schaik. Also meaning you've been talking about something else. What have we been talking about? The gam lashon acharis ein muvin klal acho inyan hu she'ein li adam bi'aylam hazeh shum simcha bi'aylam. In this world, there is no real simcha. A person has simcha, but it's temporary. A person has simcha because it's a distraction. takes his mind off the difficulties of life. Ki ma yesh li adam simcha yesh li av mi banim. We might think that the greatest simcha in the world is the joy that a parent has, a father has with their children. And yet, we know that there's plenty of tsar in there. V'tsar gidol banim kashem mikulam. Right? So actually, even stopping there, although he's going to go further, that's what it means. Even in the greatest simcha, there is pain. And the pain is tsar gidol banim. The pain of raising a child. Now, the pain of raising a child exists on many levels. It exists physically, you got to be up all night, etc. It exists emotionally, financially. If the child does not always go in the right derech, there's tremendous pain. Of course, they do tell a nice joke about the Nitziv. Maybe it's a true story, I don't know. That, you know, the Nitziv was a Meshunadik Amasman. In fact, somebody once went over to the Nitziv and said, I heard that before you were Rosh Yeshiva, you used to learn 18 hours a day. He says, absolutely sheker. It's a sheker. I only learned 16 hours a day. But I did it every single day, except Yom Kippur and Tisha B'Av, for 25 years, including Erev Shabbos, Yom Tov Chol HaMoed. And he did it from, he became Rosh Yeshiva at 40. So 40 minus 25 is how much? 15. From the age of 15 to the age of 40. Once he became Rosh Yeshiva, he couldn't stick to that schedule. But then it's, you know, so that this was his great hasmada. So they say at the marriage of one of his children, so the chuppah, let's say, was called for 2 o'clock in the afternoon, so he was sitting in his house learning by hasmada rabba, till 5 minutes before the chuppah, they called him out. And they said, you know, you have to stop now. Your daughter's getting married. So he put on his kapata and he said, ah, now I understand tsar gidol banim. So tsar gidol banim was... That's what he said. Every other day he did 16 hours a day.
When he became Rosh Yeshiva, wasn't that his Yetzihar telling him to do it? Because in the way, you know,
Well, for some people it might be a Yetzihar, yeah, but our assumption is that it was L'shem Shemayim to be Mezakeh Klal Yisrael. I mean, every time a person is Mefarsim his Torah to other people, that means he's learning a little less. But the Nitziv made a cheshbon that this was his chiyuv to the generation, to be mefarsim his Torah. So this is what's called Tsar Gidol Banim. But in many, many ways, the greater the tsar, the greater the pleasure. So in a way, it's not simply making the point that in simcha there is tsar, but rather, because of the tsar, there is simcha. You know, one of the most famous article on Kirov ever published was in Rolling Stone magazine. There was a woman, Ellen Willis, and her brother is to this day a Rebbe in Eish HaTorah. Ellen Willis is not alive anymore. But when her brother came to Eretz Yisrael from an assimilated family, and he just came just to tour, and he became from. So she was convinced that he was kidnapped by a cult and brainwashed, and she was determined to get to the bottom of this. And Rolling Stone magazine thought maybe there's some drug aspect to this. They were interested in exploring, you know, the coercive methods that mind control that the Jewish groups are using in Israel. So they gave her unlimited pages. It's amazing. I mean, she could write as big an article as she wanted. So she wrote like a 20-page article on Kirov and this and that. And it was very, very fascinating. I remember this came out in the 80s, and I was living in Chicago, and I know that the rabbis wanted to get a copy of this. But they were embarrassed to walk into a 7-Eleven and buy a Rolling Stone magazine. But, you know, it doesn't look good. Yeah. So one rav that I know waited, B'davka, Maitzeh Shabbos, till 2:30 in the morning, to go into a 7-Eleven, buy a Rolling Stone. You know, the Puerto Rican wouldn't ask any questions one way or the other. But the bachurim that were at his house for Shabbos were right there. So, oh, now I know what your rabbi's doing. You're all tired. But in the article, she recounts a series of conversations with Rav Noach Weinberg, Zichrono Livracha. And, you know, Weinberg was a very very powerful personality, very convincing personality. In fact, he was, as you may know, he was actually a founder of Or Sameach, Rav Nata and Rav Mendel, Zichrono Lebracha, and Rav Noach, Zichrono Lebracha, and Rav Yaakov Rosenberg, the founder of Machon Shlomo, Zichrono Lebracha. We're all founders. Or Sameach had four founders. And out of those four founders, we wound up with three yeshivas. Because Rav Noach did Eish afterwards, and Rav Yaakov Rosenberg did B'chon Shlomo afterwards. But it all, Or Sameach is the mother. We're like Judaism founded two other religions. You know, we founded today. But we are the mother load. But anyway, so Rav Noach was engaging her in conversation, and Rav Noach asked her, "What do you think human beings want more than anything else?" So she said, they want pleasure. We look for a life of pleasure. Now, he could have called her a hedonist, he could have called her whatever. He said to her, "I'm mighty to you, you're right. Human beings want pleasure." "Yeah, you want pleasure." He then said to her, "What's the opposite of pleasure? What do people want to avoid?" So she said, "Pain." He says, "No, pain and pleasure are not opposites. All pleasure comes from pain. The opposite of pleasure is comfort." So she said, she doesn't understand.
Pain.
I'm sorry, the opposite of pain, right? No. The opposite of pleasure is comfort. No, you'll see. The opposite of pleasure is comfort. So she said, "I don't understand. What do you mean the opposite of pleasure is comfort? Comfort, pleasure, seems to be kind of the same thing." He says, "No." He says, "Pleasure is what you get when you work and you struggle. And then you achieve something meaningful. You have pleasure. Comfort is when you never bother to put in the effort for something." And he said, even from a secular standpoint, this is a meaningful distinction. Let's say a person wants to be in the Olympics, right? Like these high school students, right? So they get up, you know, for 4 years, they get up 3 o'clock in the morning, they practice for 4 hours before school. And, you know, they have to go to sleep at nine, and, you know, they never have a social life, they never do anything. But they work and they work and they work, and then they achieve something. There's a pleasure. Comfort is the guy who never got out of bed. So he said, Yiddishkeit and Torah is not about comfort. To shred the Zayin Yid, it's not easy. The life of a Ben Torah, the life of a Bas Torah, is not an easy life. There are things you don't do, things you give up, behaviors you have to do, to go to Minyan, to sit and learn, to be Miyageya in Torah, when you don't feel like it always. But he says, that gives you the greatest pleasure in life. Because it comes, l'fum tzara. So when Chazal say, l'fum tzara agra, from the suffering is the reward, Rav Noach said, it's lav dafka only in Olam Haba. Even in Olam Hazeh, there's a certain bracha you have when you're miyageya in something. It's true in marriage, too. A person works on a marriage, then they cherish it. It's true in parenting. This is why sometimes, although theoretically parents love all children the same, but it's not always exactly that way. And sometimes it might be the child they had to work the hardest with, the child with the most problems, that they invested the most kochos. In fact, this is Rav Dessler's insight. Rav Dessler's insight is, why is it that parents have a stronger love for children than children have for their parents? It's true. It is true. And it is because the parents put so much into the child. And what you're miyageya in, you treasure. Chazal say, Adam reitza b'kav shalai, yaisim yitisha kavin shalkarera. I treasure the one little measure of grain or vegetables that I planted more than nine that I get from somebody else. And the famous Rashi explains, al yaday sha'amal b'hem. Because what I worked for is very, very precious for me. What I get with a silver platter is not so precious for me. Okay, so Mimela, that is the idea that in a positive way, see, in other words, this pasuk is both making a negative statement and a positive statement. On one hand, it's making the statement that there are two meanings here. In the frivolity and hefkeris of the world, where you think there is happiness, there is ultimate pain. But you read the same pasuk in a reverse message. And in the things that bring you pain and struggle, you will find ultimate happiness, right? It's a, it's like an anagram. I don't remember the word anymore. I'm forgetting my English, but you read it in both directions. Yeah.
Could the Rebbe read it in time that way?
Say it, which one?
Just so I can see it both ways.
Yes. Gam bischaik yichav lev. In levity, so one interpretation is in levity, frivolity, in the superficial entertainments of life, there is ultimate pain and sadness. In other words, this is like Koheles' message, right? This world is hevel, this world is futile, this world is worthless. That's one way of looking at it. But the other way of looking at it is, gam bischaik yichav lev. In the activities that bring you ultimate joy, there will be pain. Meaning to say, no pain, no gain. Right? That a person that lefum sara agra, and as Rav Noach said, that is even true in Olam Hazeh. It's not only true in Olam Haba. And you'll see, people will say, you know, I use secular analogies because this is a machshava that has emes in all aspects of life. Let's say people have built a business from scratch. And in the early years, there was struggles and disappointments and near bankruptcies. And then they reach a level where they've made it. They'll often say, the happiest years of my life were the years of building something. Because we worked, you know, we worked, we struggled. And although, v'shas maisa, a person doesn't have that hakara always. But in retrospect, you say, those were the things. Those are the things that were the most meaningful. The years of building something, even in a marriage, the years of building something together. You know?
A parent loves a child that he invested, that they invested the most. Does that mean that Hashem, since he was there from the very beginning, he also invested the most?
That's right.
And doesn't that mashma that since Hashem invested even more, that Hashem invested in the parents, in the child's parents as well, so Hashem had an even bigger investment.
So it's
mashma also in the grandparents and in all his ancestors. The more we move through time, Hashem's investment in us is bigger and bigger. So therefore, each new generation can move up more and more because it's just a bigger investment.
I hear what you're saying. That's very interesting. I mean, I think it would be a little shrewd, though, to say. So you're telling me Hashem loves us more than he loved people 100 years ago?
Because our investment for us, like...
Because the cumulative investment is greater. But Rav Dessler points out, I know you've heard this over the years, that Rav Dessler points out that the shayrish of ahava, loving, is hav. Now hav is a word meaning give. Because he says, we think I give because I love. In reality, it is my giving that creates the love. That by giving, by sacrificing, by working, by striving, that is how I love. And that's why ava is love through giving. And he points out in a very tragic way that he wrote this before World War II, that in World War I, children were separated from their parents for a number of years. And when the parents were reunited with the children, although there was happiness, but it was not the same relationship, simply because. This is what they say now, you know, this is one of the tragedies of divorce. People say, well, the main thing with the child is quality time, right? So instead of, I don't have my son, all the time. But I have him once a month, and we do really great things together. But the emphasis is, you can't have quality time unless you have a lot of quantity time. There's a lot of time doing nothing at all, just hanging around, just the fact that you're here. You might be sitting with a sefer, you might be whatever it is. But the fact that a parent is around, so the child gets something from the parent, just being around. And without that quantity time, things cannot be the same. And that's what the Ava has to come from the constant giving.
Right, since Hashem, it's obvious Hashem loves Yaakov Avinu, Moshe Rabbeinu much more than us. I was thinking that a lot of things that Hashem invested about have to be written off. Eitz Hadas was a write-off. First set of Luchos was a write-off. For the Beis HaMikdash 1 and 2 was a write-off. So even though Hashem invested, but it had to be like a
lot of losses.
Yeah. The stock went down.
Needs a good tax accountant. Okay. Yeah, in the Hanami. Okay. Alrighty. So just to finish what the Gra says, the Gra then goes on and says, "V'chayinam rizal b'medrash." He quotes a medrash. Ma'ase sheviu l'melach shulchan echad shen karei b'chol ha'ilam. People brought the king a beautiful table that was magnificent. V'samach ha'melach mi'ayit. The king was very happy. V'shalach achar kol chachama v'shalom ala shulchan. He asked him, how do you make such a table? Apparently, whatever the design was, a very unique design. Umispayar asmei bay mi'ayit. And he was glorifying himself in the shulchan. V'yana chacham echad. And the chacham told him, Hashulchan hulai rakli yagain v'yanacha. This shulchan will bring you nothing but sadness and grief. Don't be so happy with it. The melech didn't understand. But pamachas yared hamelech b'sfina. One time the king went on a boat. Umachama shedaito haisek shurabai. He was so attached to this beautiful table. Not the leisei gamken. He's traveling on a boat. He has to take this table with him. What happened was, nafal ha'shulchan l'toch ha'mayim. Whatever it was, either things had to be thrown overboard or there was a storm, and his shulchan went into the water. V'kafzu kol yordei hayam, v'chol yodei ha'mashayit, divers, and they all jumped over to try to retrieve the table. V'lo yachlu, they couldn't retrieve it. It went to the bottom of the ocean. U'machamas gaidol ha'tsar chola ha'melech. This is a medrash. And because of the tsar, the king became sick. V'yana ha'isay ha'chacham. So the chacham said, I told you so. I told you this table is going to just bring you sadness. Halay zahu divaray asher samti b'picha shein zeh le'yagay. V'yamar lo ha'melech. Hanavi atash adeh gozais. How did you know that I would be so upset at because of this table? Ana v'yamar. Lai navi anaychi v'lo ben navi anaychi. Avol kach mekublani. I was makabo. Lefi erech hasimcha. Actually, the Gaon is looking at the first interpretation. The greater the joy, the greater the loss. In fact, there are people, there is a philosophy in life. Some people have. They don't want to get married. They don't want to have children. They don't want to form attachments. Because the pain of loss is going to be so great that they would rather not be nichnas into the simcha if it's going to cause pain. That's really an aspect of life. Again, the Gra is not looking at it the second way, right? The second way, as I indicated, through the pain we get simcha. He's looking at it this way. Through simcha we get pain, because all simcha of Olam Hazeh is temporary. One day you're going to lose it. Again, I mean, it's a tragic, should be Mea V'Yesrim and Mea V'Yesrim Shana V'Yait. But everybody is going to die until Kriyas HaMetzah. So, again, I don't want to depress people. A husband and wife gets married. Unless they die simultaneously, usually one is going to die before the other. And somebody is going to be left a bereaved widow or widower. Tremendous pain. They wouldn't have had that pain. They wouldn't have had that pain if they didn't do this. So this is kind of a tragedy. Now again, the answer to that is not to have the simcha, but to understand that the nature of Olam Hazeh is that the deeper the simcha, the more the pain. Because the more you care about something, the more attached you are. And that is that's why a person should put his kochos into that which has nitzchias. V'cheinu gam kein b'schaik. Avol b'schaik yesh o davar gadol min ha-simcha. Sha-simcha al kol panim b'shas ha-simcha libo sameach. Okay, so let me explain what he's doing here. The Gra is offering this interpretation. You will notice that there are two words for happiness. S'chaik, which is playing or laughter, and simcha. So he seems to be explaining it this way. Simcha are the things that are intrinsically simchas. The simcha of a marriage, of children, of accomplishing good things in this world. That's a simcha. Sechaik is stamazai, levity, kalas reish. So the chiluk is the following. in simcha, although it's all a good thing, acharisa tuga, eventually you're going to lose it. So there's going to be sadness. But still, go ahead and do it. In schaik, there is pain even b'shas maisa itself, because even b'shas maisa, you know you're wasting your time and you're wasting your life. So the way he interprets it is, gam b'shaik, in levity, there is pain even b'shas maisa. And even in simcha, the acharis of simcha is going to be tuga. Okay, that's how he learns the psukim and the like. Yeah. But be it as it may, as I say, this is the idea that the deeper the love, the deeper the care, the greater is the loss. But the Eibishter says we still do what we have to do. But with schaik, even b'shas maisa, how much schaik is really a diversion from the misery that a person feels? Rav Shiller likes to say, you know, when he likes to have his toasts of scotch. So he has a whole word on this. He says that outside of the Torah world, people drink to kind of deaden themselves. They don't want to feel. They don't want to feel anymore. In other words, there's so much pain in life, they want to deaden their sensations. We say l'chaim, we drink to become more alive, more vibrant, and the like. But a lot of the diversions of Olam Hazeh are escapes. Drugs, alcohol, all of these things are escapes from a very, very deep misery. So in the schaik, you look like you're laughing, having a great time. There's really a tremendous pain. In simcha, in true simcha, there's not pain in the simcha, because it's simcha. But there is even in that an acharis, an aftermath. That's tuga. That's the mashal of the shulchan. So the message ultimately, therefore, is that even in simcha, which is a good thing to do in this world, but one's primary investment should be in things that are nitzchias, things that do last. And those are the inyanim that you take with you to Olam Haba, which are the Torah and the Masim Tovim that you do. Okay, so that's so again, he helps us because the ratio of the pasuk is schaik, and the ke'ev is simultaneous. The seifa of the pasuk is simcha, and the tuga is the aftermath. Right, so that's how he analyzes the pasuk that way. Okay, maybe we'll stop there tonight. Yep.
Simcha is
so the simcha is what?
His simcha here is olam hazeh.
Yes, it's olam hazeh simcha for good things. For good things.
Oh.
Well, that's what he's saying. Shachayik is the waste of time, and simcha is like tsar gidol banim, etc. He says there's a tsar for them.
Yeah. The Rebbe mentioned before that if somebody scares somebody and that person dies, let's say a person played a joke, they scared somebody and they died.
Yeah.
Is that like love of the doll? Does that person chayif for killing somebody?
Is he chayiv misa? No, he would not be chayiv misa because it was not expected. Now the question is, would he go to a near miklat? Is it considered shogeg or onus? In other words, if it's shogeg, he would go to the city of exile. If it's considered to be a totally unexpected. So usually speaking, these things are not that normal. Most of the time, you don't expect someone to die from it. So he would not even go to the city of refuge unless he knew that this person was very, very susceptible. Then perhaps it might be a shogeg.
And Rabbi.
Yeah.
Did you? Sorry, just on the previous point. You said, going on what you said, you should focus on the things that you know have a future. Yeah. So, tending simcha is like people's weddings and stuff. A good enough reason for that.
Well, I would say this though. Yeah, you have to understand. Yeah, you know, well, number one, it's a mitzvah. But number two, you don't necessarily go to. You know, the Nesiv writes that the din, that you're mevatlin Talmud Torah. There is a halacha that you stop learning Torah for what is called hachnasas kala, to bring the kala to the chuppah. Right? So that does indicate, you're mevatl Torah. The Nitziv says that's talking about, which really doesn't even happen today, where the wedding is passing, they're doing it outside, and they're, they're passing by, right by you, so you take off four amos, you know, to escort. It doesn't mean, you know, you go to Chicago to go to a friend's wedding. So the din that you're mevatel Torah for a chasna certainly does not mean you stay for the whole chasna anyway, even without the nitziv. Now, so the alternative heter would be this. The alternative heter would be a general rule that any mitzvah that could not be done by somebody else, you are mevatel Torah for. That is a general halacha. So here is the issue. If you have a special relationship with the chasna, and therefore your relationship is such that if you're not there, there's a real pain, so then you're mevatel Torah, not because of the halacha of mevatel Talmud Torah l'hachnasas kala, but because of the halacha with the mitzvah shi'i efshir lasas. But if you're, I don't want to paskin on this because it would be very hard for people, but if you're, you know, you like to go to weddings, you know, but you're kind of a, you know, you're not close to the chasan in particular, then it's not so pleasant that you could just be mevatel your regular learning session. You know, if it's been a storm or something, and like, you know. So one shouldn't be hefker about this. You know, there's a joke of Rabbi Kornetsky used to say, it was a joke. Chazal say, Ein ben chayrin ele mishayisek b'torah. Chazal say, the only person who is free is a person who learns Torah. So we talk about you're free from the Yetzer Hara, right? We have all of the good things. He said it in kind of a sarcastic way. He says, if you have a job, you can't just take off for every wedding that comes down the pike. He says, if you're learning, I can take off for everything. So he says, only a person learning is totally free. I can go to this, I can go to that, I can go to that. So you have to kind of, I wouldn't say this is the halachic definition per se, but it's helpful to look at Torah as your job. Lasek divrei Torah. Well, is this the type of thing I would take off if I was on a job, you know? So if it's my son getting married, I would. If it's a distant person, I wouldn't, right? So you have to take Torah with the same chashivas, at least, that you take a job. Like the Chavetz Chaim is a sefer, very good sefer. They reprinted it recently in big letters. Maimer Torah Sabayis. It's a little kundrus. Chavetz Chaim wrote a lot of small svarim on different inyanim. So this was his sefer on Talmud Torah. So he didn't just write on Lashon Hara, he wrote on Psalms and Devarim, but he wrote Musar on many, many inyanim. And he takes it on a pasuk in Mishlei that I think we read earlier, im techapsene kakesef, that if you look for it like silver and matmonim and like treasure, us tavin yiras Hashem. So his whole thesis is, the whole sefer is miyusid on the analogy that you have to look at learning Torah the way you look at making money in a business. With the same planning, the same conscientiousness, the same discipline, and the like. So I think this would apply to weddings and all sorts of other events and the like. Like, ask yourself, you know, is this something that's so important to me and to him that I would take off from my work if I had to do it? Now, you may then say to me, Torah, you mean all you're doing is comparing Torah to work? That's what you're saying? Well, so let me remind you, this is what the Talmidim of Rav Yechonon ben Zakkai said, right? On his deathbed, he said, may you fear Hashem as much as you fear people. And they said, that's all? He says, halavai. He says, when a person is about to do an avera, he asks, is anybody watching me? You know, he's afraid of the people. He's not afraid of Hashem. So halavai. So I can tell you, halavai. We would be machshiv Torah as much as we're machshiv work. Okay. And when you reach that level, we'll talk about the next. We'll talk about the next level afterwards.
On Wall Street, when there's a stock market crash, everybody is like terrified, and they have this terrified look on themselves. That's the same we should feel for Bittul
Torah. That's right. That's right. That's very good. That's very good. That's very good. Yeah. Like they say, there was a chassid who said he was once caught. He was once caught in the middle of a World War I, a battle. And he was trying to describe to someone what it felt like to be in the middle of a battle where bullets are whizzing all over your head and you could die at any second. And he said, you cannot believe the pachad, the mora. He said, he was thinking and thinking and thinking. it was almost like Ne'ilan Yom Kippur. That's what. So you see, that was the Madrega. Okay, all right, you have a good week.
Is it safe to say that the mark of Choshech was a marker for us, not from the Mitzvah?
In order that the 4/5 Shadayimim?
Yeah. Because in a way, we got hurt from that marker more than them, so yeah. It must be. So Egyptians got 9, we got 1.
You can learn that way. Yeah. There are midrashim that also talk about Choshech as an onesh for the Mitzrayim,
but
a punishment for the Egyptians. Yeah. Man imagines that, but you're right. Rashi brings that Hashem wanted the 4/5 were chayav misa. Hashem didn't want the Egyptians to see them die.
For just wanting to stay there.
Yeah.
Hashem usually he gives before a person gets chayav misa, he gets a warning.
Yeah.
Like before somebody desecrates Shabbos, he gets a warning, then he gets chayav misa. If they would have gotten a warning saying that you are gonna die if you don't leave. They already, after 8 plagues, they already seen, 8 markers, they already seen that what Hashem could do, they would leave, they would pack their bags. They would leave out of fear, not out of love for Hashem. But the fact that Hashem just said, you know what, I know who's going to stay, who's going to leave, so I'm just going to take them out. But if somebody would have just told them, listen, Hashem is going to, he's going to kill people who don't want to leave, so just... If you believe in God, leave. They would have out of fear. I guess they would have. Sure. Who wants to die? Like.
Yeah. On the other hand, the 4/5 reached the 50th level of tumah. So they're no longer worthy of redemption. The only question is, you're raising an interesting question, because even if they're not worthy of redemption.
They're not worthy.
They're not deserving of redemption.
I thought they didn't reach the 50th level.
The 1/5 that survived didn't reach the 50th level. But the 4/5 reached the 50th level. That's why they died.
What did they do? They didn't do Avodah Zarah. They didn't. Oh.
Well, they did Avodah Zarah, but whatever reaching the 50th level means, they reached it.
I feel like it was like if a person roasts a turkey, you roast it in an oven for a long time, and a lot of it gets burned, like 80% of it gets burned, only the 20% meat that is inside stays.
So that's what it was.
So that's what Hashem did.
So the 4/5 had reached the 50th level. They were not redeemable anymore. So even if they would want to go out, this is not a question that they didn't want to go out.
What happened to them?
What happened to everyone? I mean, the other people are 49 and slipping. There's not that much difference between them. But over 210 years, they became assimilated to the Egyptians.
They couldn't. We could not open up our Sameach for them, and or Eishes Torah and bring them back. It was.
Apparently not. Apparently, when you hit the 50th level, although it's interesting, there is a word of Chaim Lashner that says. The idea that when you hit level 50, you're not redeemable, is only before Matan Torah. Once there's Matan Torah, even if someone hits the 50th level, so Eishes Torah wouldn't have worked then, or Eishes Torah wouldn't have worked then, because Kaidim Matan Torah, the Kayach of the Torah was not there. But maybe now anybody could be redeemed.
But they were very close to Yaakov, or Shvatim, because it wasn't such a long time. Between them and the Shvatim.
Okay, but even the 1/5 that were redeemed were on the 49th level of Tumah. So apparently everybody was on a very low Madrig, except for
Rabbi, is it safe to say that what happened in Mitzrayim on the Choshech, it's worse than Holocaust anyway? Because they experienced, because they suffered the numbers and the time of period was.
Even numerically, it was much worse than the Holocaust.
Yeah,
that's right.
Yeah, it was
it's amazing. 4/5, according to some, it's
10 million.
Much more than that, even. 4/5 is a smaller number that Rashi uses. The Midrashim gives bigger numbers. 4/5. I mean, the total population was probably 15 million.
Yeah.
And you're left with 3 million coming out, so 12 million people, double the Holocaust died.
In a short period of time, so 3 days.
Didn't the Mitzrayim notice the next morning?
wouldn't they notice the next morning? Yeah, so, the question would be, what did HaKadosh Baruch Hu do with the bodies? So there, the Midrashim, that they took the bodies out. Right. Yeah. There's also another midrash I just saw today, a very amazing midrash, but I don't know how it fits exactly, that HaKadosh Baruch Hu took them up and then put them down on a mountain, and they were able to nurse. They got nourishment from the mountain. That's the Inakeyu Devash Misela. They were able to get honey from the mountain. Which implies they, now, if the Medrash is suggesting they actually lived, that would be very, very crazy, because the numbers of the Yidden who left Mitzrayim were 600,000. We did not include that number.
Right.
So, but apparently, either the Medrash is Merames that there were a lot of Jews, which, again, a very interesting story, who didn't enter Eretz Israel, who were put in other parts of the world, which is really amazing. That would be a parallel Jewish population. What was their history?
It's on the four fifths.
Yeah. Or the Medrash is Merames that they had a chelik in Olam Haba, that they were taken physically, but they were put in Olam Haba.
Rabbi, what about the schus of Abraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov? Why didn't that schus help save them?
Doesn't help when you're on the 50th level.
It wouldn't have helped even
the one-fifth. If Hashem waited, that's why Hashem couldn't wait more than 210 years. Had he waited a little more, then the Zichus Avos wouldn't have helped for the one-fifth either. They had to be redeemed before they hit the 50th level.
Rabbi, Hashem cried when the Mitzrayim died by splitting of the sea. But he, over here, he's...
I'm sure Hashem cried here too.
Because at least let the Egyptians them live as goyim, like no whites or something. Like it's mashma. Hashem says it's either black or white. There's no gray.
No, a Jew can't live like that. I mean, if a Jew can't be a Jew, so Hashem, Hashem took that they weren't. They hit the 50th level.
And Rabbi, also, I feel like there was a connection to. Is it safe to say that between Hoshech and Holocaust, we never suffered such numbers in the world?
Well, Chazal gives the numbers for Beitar as huge, huge numbers, more than the Holocaust, but some commentaries say it's an exaggeration.
What happened in Beitar? So
Beitar, the Beis HaMikdash, the second temple, was destroyed by the Romans in the year 70. But around 60 years later, we had the Bar Kokhba. Bar Kokhba led a revolt.
Wow.
To try to build the third Beis HaMikdash. Rabbi Akiva was a supporter of Bar Kokhba. He thought Bar Kokhba was Mashiach. And the Romans destroyed that rebellion. The final battle was in Beitar. And that was also in Tisha B'Av. And that, in terms of the numbers of people killed, it was much more than the Korban Beis HaMikdash.
Like
there was no Nebuah. There was no Nebuah. I mean, they didn't have prophets then. So Beitar was...
How many died in Beitar?
I have to go back to the numbers, but it describes millions and millions and millions of people. But again, some say it's a guzman. And the Romans didn't allow the dead to be buried for 3 years. 3 years. And there was a miracle that the bodies did not decompose. And the 15th of Av, 3 years and 1 week later, we were given permission to bury the dead. And that's when Chazal added the fourth bracha in benching, Hatova HaMeitiv. Hashem is good, and Hashem does good. Hashem is good that Nitnu Shelo Hashrichu, that the bodies didn't decompose. And Hashem does good, Hashem Nitnu L'Kvura, we were allowed to bury the bodies.
Rabbi, also like during the World War II, when people heard that it was very bad in certain countries. They could have left, but they thought it's gonna go away.
Yep.
Maybe some people didn't believe that the Germany was doing what they were doing, because like it's not so easy to believe such a thing. Could it be that because people had love for the Karka, love for the land they were in, they were finding excuses not to leave? Same thing in Hoshech. People did not want to leave Mitzrayim because they love the Karka over there. They love the land, and that because their love for the foreign land made them casualties. So too, like in World War II, because on one hand, a person could leave, but say, you know what,
I can't, because like they love the carpet, and that love for the carpet for the foreign land, it's like an analogy.
It doesn't apply to the United States.
yeah. Everywhere, any foreign carpet.
Rabbi Wein, Beryl Wein, tells the story that when he built, he has a yeshiva in Muncie. He built the yeshiva in Muncie when they were building the building. So he had a contributor who wanted to build special wood that grows in Finland. And this wood has a life in a building of 150 years, as opposed to average wood, which I guess is 50 years, he says. So he says, I'll give you this wood. He says, he's not going to build anything in the Gullus to last 150 years. He says, the person builds like permanent permanent structures, it's like they're not Maimon and Gola. It's brought down from the Shlach. Shlach Kaddish actually says this, that he was a Mochiach Yidden who built stone and brick houses in the Gullus. Because you build a house that lasts forever, you know, forever. That means, you know, you're saying this is where I'm going to be.
I was thinking there's a connection between this Parsha and Sukkot. Because on Sukkot, Davka, that's the lesson. Live temporary. Right. Be ready to move out. It's all an illusion. What you like? Be ready to live in a sukkah. Yeah. So hoishek, hoishek is what the downside. If a person is not ready to leave, right. Is not ready to just pack bags and go. In that case, that's the consequence. But sukkah, Hashem says, throughout your generations, I want you to just be ready.
You have to be ready to move. Yeah, that's what they say. When the grower is 5 years old, they ask the makasha. You know, we make a Gezeirah Sheva. We compare Pesach and Sukkot. That's just like Pesach is the 15th of Nisan, Sukkot is the 15th of Tishrei, and that's how we know you have to eat a kezias of bread, just like you have to eat a kezias of matzah. So they asked the Vilna Gaon, he was 5 years old, a young child. He says, you know, if we compare Sukkot and Pesach, why don't we have a manishtana? Why don't we have the four questions on Sukkot? So he answered as a child. He says, you know, Sukkot, we leave our house, we wander. He says, that's not a kasha. We do that the whole year. A Jew has to be ready to move every second. Every second the guy is going to leave here. He says, Pesach, we have a fancy table, we have china, we have silver. Manishtana, you know, that's so different from my regular life.
A Jew has to... That's Lashon of bitter or sorrow. What's the word?
Tuga, is a word that means sadness, despair.
Where's the
Sharis is connected to Noga, which is a darkness. So what is the Sharis? I don't know. I think it's Yud Gimel Hay, but
it's more of a sorrow, more like bitter. Taklus says Chamutza.
It's not. I don't think it's bitter. I think it's more of a nostalgic. In other words, the idea that you had something you no longer have. Tuga Saleh, that's what he's saying, the Harisa, the notion of losing something that you loved.
It could be that's what the Targum means.
Chamutza? Chamutza.
Vinegar is wine that was sweet and now it's...
Ah, okay, that's a good comparison.
Right. Yeah. I feel that there was a lot of similarities between Hoishah and the Holocaust. One more similarity is that when it was like the humiliation of the Jewish people, that was done publicly. By the enforcement of hard labor, same thing during World War II, before the Holocaust, because there were stages.
Yeah.
But when it was time for actual, killing of the people, Hashem made it very private, very away from the people's eyes. The Egyptians did not see it; they were kept in the dark.
Yeah.
And the taking of the lives took place. So too, during the Holocaust, the people, average citizen, were kept in the dark. And to the mass killing.
I wouldn't call the extermination of the Jews like a big secret. Auschwitz. You know, Auschwitz.
Yeah. No. Like
had a town next to Auschwitz. I mean, they would see black smoke and they would smell.
They knew.
Yeah. They knew. I mean, maybe they didn't want to think about it, but they certainly knew. Auschwitz was a chashuv town, Ushpitzin. I mean, we have Sfarim from Rabbanim of Ushpitzin. These were, there were Yidden, there had been Jews in the town.
I can tell you, my uncle liberated Buchenwald. My grandmother's brother, he was in the U.S. Army. Went there, so he liberated. Yeah,
liberated.
Not Auschwitz, he liberated Dachau for sure. I think also in maybe Buchenwald also. Mm-hmm. So he told me straight. I asked, I watched the movie about it, I talked to him about it. He was very disturbed by it. He was very funny. He told me the stench was so great. What they did was they brought the people from the surrounding area. He said, he was there. He was in communications. He videotaped. He did this footage. They brought the people from the villages and to see dead bodies. He was there. And he said, there's just no way. He said, to me, this day, when that told me, he never forgot the smell. He still says, every day I remember that smell. Every day. He says, there's no way the people who live like a kilometer, there's no way they didn't know. That's what he told me.
Because the Nazis tried to keep it a secret. They tried to. Okay, yeah, but
maybe they tried. But, you know,
yeah.
Now there's another thing, though. You know, if you remember the Gemara in Gittin, which is the Agadah about the Churban Beis Hamikdash, so it mentions that Rav Yechanan ben Zakkai, the emperor told him, or the general told him, came at Titus, Aspasianus, Vespasian, ask for whatever you want, I'll give it to you. And he asked for, you know, he said, Yavne, give me Yavne. Give me a spare Rabban Gamliel and give a doctor for Rav Tzadok. So the Gemara says, why didn't he ask to spare the Beis HaMikdash? So the Gemara says he thought he'd be asking for too much, to fast to Meruba, he wouldn't get anything. But the Gemara says, Meshev Chachamim Ocher B'daitim Yisokal, that means when Hashem decrees in Shemayim that there has to be an Einish, the Chachamim simply lose their wisdom. And they don't come up with the right thought. The thought that you need just doesn't occur to you. Hashem was Monea that thought. So in some ways, the Holocaust seems to be a parallel situation, meaning to say, for reasons we don't know, the Eibishter was Geyser, Amida Sadin. And if the Chachamim didn't give an Eitzah to leave, and sometimes they didn't, it's Mamish the din of Meshev Chachamim Ocher. At the time of Rizcha, time of Kas, the Chachamim sometimes lose their ability to give the correct answer. The Gemara says it on Rav Yochanan ben Zakkai.
It wasn't a machloikas. People, the Chachamim, usually it's a machloikas, but in this situation.
Well, in this particular case, he was the only one who was in a position. I mean, he was alone with the emperor. Nobody else was there. So he was put on the spot. The emperor says to him, unexpectedly, you know, what do you want? Whatever you want, I'll give you. So, the thought didn't occur to him. So even though he had a reason, because he thought he'd be asking for too much, but it seems from the Gemara that it was a mistake. And the Gemara says, there's a time when HaKadosh Baruch Hu, it's like Hashem hardened Paro's heart. Hashem is machshil the chacham, in order that the midas hadin should be mekoyim. So you can't blame the chacham. You can't say, oh, why didn't the Chacham think? For Kert, it was a divine intervention that he shouldn't have that thought. That's what the Gemara says by Yochanan ben Zakkai. So you can't tie. So when people say like this, people say, the rabbis were wrong. So my answer is, yeah, the rabbis were wrong. But that doesn't mean they were wrong. It means Hashem made them give the wrong answer because it was the Ratzon Hashem that people would not leave at that point.
And then the obvious question was, how do I know what's going on right now? And maybe they're wrong too.
So the answer is, you don't know, but you have to go with probability. In other words, it's relatively rare. Usually for Kert, usually a Kodesh Baruch Hu gives the Chachamim to give us the Hadracha that's good. Well, or I'll say this. I mean, in other words,
whatever should be,
their hadracha is the Ratzon Hashem. That's exactly their hadracha, Ratzon Hashem. Even if it leads to destruction, that just means it was the Ratzon Hashem that did it.
You have to make a decision to leave somewhere or stay somewhere, etc.
Yeah, that
you may not be
for you as a yachid. Yeah,
you may have to make.
That's a problem. That is a problem. And indeed, there were kamavidim. They did make decisions. She was Mir. I mean, they moved him. They moved him around. But Hungary was a big problem. I mean, the Gedolim in Hungary, because, the Nazis didn't come to Hungary till late in the war. So Hitler already looked like they were going to be defeated. So they just told him, stay. And then Hungarian Jewry was wiped out like mamish, like lightning. It was just very, very quick. Poland, it took, you know, it took 3 years. Hungary was 6 months. It was a smaller population.
But most survivors were also Hungarian, right? It works out also, the ones of southern.
Yeah, yeah, because they had the, that's when they were doing deals already.
Deals and
Kastner, and yeah, that's when they were cutting deals. But those who were killed very quickly. They killed like 600,000 in a very, very short amount of time. Yeah. All righty, good.